All right, so I'm talking to you about the founder of Human Rights, and of course that's a somewhat polemical and catchy title, but I'm going to make a case that Francisco de Vitoria, who probably many of you have not heard about, or if you've heard about him, you've only heard his name, is really somebody who's at the heart of thinking about the kinds of content that we associate with the term human rights, okay? He did not use the term human rights, and that should not come as a surprise. That's a much later development that people start to use this language. For most of Western tradition, when rights start to be named, they're called natural rights or specific kinds of rights, like the jus communicandi or other kinds of rights like that. But human rights is a later term. But the content, I hope you'll see, traces back to a much earlier time. Everyone wants to claim credit for the term human rights, and for good reason. Human rights connote, as the historian Samuel Moyne has written, the highest moral principles and political ideals. They bring to mind heroic women and men standing against injustices like slavery and genocide, against arbitrary imprisonment, and also standing for justice movements, including, for instance, movements in favor of emancipation, the extension of the vote to all people, regardless of color, sex, or economic standing, and for conscience protections. We all want to be for human rights, and we all want to claim our forebears, Catholic or Protestant, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, or atheist. We all want to claim that they were somehow instrumental in human rights coming into being. But there's another reason for claiming credit for the term, and that's to control the story, both backwards and forwards, to exclude some figures and institutions in favor of other figures and institutions, and to direct human rights towards certain things and away from other things. In this vein, excluding the role of Catholics and other Christians makes it easier to resist extending human rights to, for instance, the unborn. A standard approach to the literature on human rights is to exclude, as possible contributors to the term's emergence, religious figures and institutions. So, for instance, Moyne, in his book, The Last Utopia, argues for perhaps the narrowest historical horizon for human rights. The modern concept of human rights, he argues, traces not to the Enlightenment, nor to the 18th and 19th century humanitarian movements around slavery, for instance, and the vote, extending the vote to women, nor even to the emergence of the United Nations and a body of international law out of the ashes of the Holocaust and the world's experiences with an attempted Jewish genocide. Instead, Moyne claims, human rights came seemingly from nowhere, in the crises of alternative internationalisms in the 1950s and 60s. In other words, according to Moyne, human rights emerged in the 1970s. That would make it very recent, right? Not even as old as I am. Now, Moyne's book is more sophisticated than I have the time to show, and I am setting up his account as a foil, but so be it. The book's inattention to the role of faith traditions, and to Catholicism in particular, invites this approach. Let me give you a glimpse. At one point, later in his book, he asserts there had been no serious philosophical support for natural rights, let alone human rights, in the 20th century until John Rawls's A Theory of Justice in 1971. Okay, so in the 20th century, he argues there's no serious, I'm going to read the text again, no serious philosophical support for natural rights until Rawls writes his book. It makes one wonder, of course, how much work the qualifiers serious philosophical and support are doing in that sentence, as he makes no mention of, say, Pope John XXIII's Pacem in Terris of 1963, or the entire tradition of natural rights thinking in Germany, France, and England that give birth to that document. Perhaps then he means something very specific by human rights. He divines this notion from nowhere as applicable to all, regardless of citizenship or state status. In other words, it doesn't matter if you're French, Spanish, Brazilian or whatever, right? The human rights extend to all of us without regard to state. And based on a conception of humanity and enforced by natural law. So those are sort of the three parts of his understanding of the term human rights that he believes emerges in the 1970s, right? Doesn't matter your state status or citizenship status. It's based on some conception of humanity, again, that itself doesn't root itself in state understandings, and then also is enforced by international law. Now, unless the point of Moyne's argument is that no one previously meant all three of those things and also used the terms human rights, I think we have a contender all the way back in the 16th century for someone who contributed to and perhaps even founded the modern conception of human rights in Francisco de Vitoria. Because Vitoria, as we shall see, advanced a conception of humanity that included and protected all human beings without regard to the biases and shortcomings of his age. So let's take a look at Vitoria, who has been called by many the conscience of Spain. Vitoria was, as Father said, a Spanish Dominican friar. He studied at the University of Paris from 1511 to 1523. So in other words, born in the late 15th century, dies in about the early middle of the 16th century, okay? Studies and is active from about 1511 till almost 1540 or so, okay? Long time ago, a lot longer ago than 1970. During this time, as we know, Spain was extending its reach over the recently discovered Indies with all the material advantages that accrued to the Spanish crown and all the material disadvantages accruing to the indigenous population of the Americas. At the same time that he's in Paris, the influential Scottish philosopher John Mayer, sometimes called John Major, was teaching at Paris. There's some dispute, apparently, over whether John Mayer actually taught Vitoria, but there's little doubt that Vitoria knew of Mayer's view that in the Indies, Aristotle's theory of natural slavery had been proven. Okay, if you know Aristotle's theory, if any of you studied Aristotle, you know he sort of posits the possibility that there are people who by birth are fit to be slaves, right? Their bodies are sort of, you know, built in a particular way, right, to make them more suited for manual labor, and also they lack practical rationality. They lack the rationality of those who are fit to be masters. Mayer believes that in the Indies we've found the people, the kinds of people that Aristotle's describing. And this is a quotation from Mayer. Hence, the first to conquer them, the first to conquer these peoples, justly rules over them, because they are slaves by nature. As the philosopher, as Aristotle says, this is still his quotation, it is clear that some men are slaves by nature and others free by nature. And it is just that one should be slave and the other free. Okay? Good stuff, right? To most of us, the story of Spanish involvement in the Americas is well known. The Spaniards stumble upon indigenous peoples on their way to the Indies and begin the morally ambiguous process of evangelization and colonization. The moral ambiguity provokes, already in the early 1500s, a dispute over the legitimacy of Spanish activity that leads in 1512 to the first piece of colonial legislation, the Law of Burgos, which forbade abuses and endorsed evangelization, but also entrenches the encomienda system, which ties indigenous peoples to small plots of land and landowners in perpetuity. The system has been called by some, you know, historians slavery by another name, okay? Right, so they come in, right, they take things over, they get control very quickly, start abusing them, and the Spanish crown realizes there's something kind of wrong with this, okay, because they're Catholic, right, and they bring in their best people to think about the problem, and they come up with laws intended to be more humane, right, to curb these abuses and really to sort of focus the conquest, focus the colonization on evangelization. But of course, they're a world away, right, and the capacity to enforce this is very limited. And what instead happens, of course, is this kind of entrenchment of the encomienda system. Despite this humanizing intent, then, of the law, the pressure of colonizing expansion increases with the discovery and conquest of Mexico in the 1520s, I hope I didn't do that, and Peru in the 1530s. I wish I was that good. By the time Vittoria looked at the question, which is around 1532, the central issue, he thought, was by what right, the barbarians are subjected to Spanish rule. What is the right that allows the Spaniards to dominate the barbarians, is his term. And the related question of Indian possession, or dominium is the Latin term. Dominium, right? Think of what that connotes. Dominium, dominion, right? Lordship. By what right Indians could have possession over their own territories, their actions, and even themselves. Put differently, the question was whether the barbarians were human or not. Okay, whether they're human or not, because if they have the rights of possession, if they have the rights of self-mastery, then of course they're human. For only humans could be the subjects of right, and primarily of the right of possession or dominium. Vittoria's response to these questions are pretty well known, but they're worth rehearsing just a couple of them, as they provide the grounds for seeing in him an early contributor to our understanding of rights. The first thing we note about his response, and here he's indebted to his brother Dominicans who traveled to the New World, because he'd never been. Okay, he had never been. Bartolome de las Casas, who's probably more famous than Vittoria, had been, right? He actually was the son of wealthy people. He owned, their family owned property and ran plantations. But many Dominicans were going back and forth to Spain and providing testimonies. Many of these testimonies, of course, are literally spectacular. There are fantastic accounts of cannibalism, child sacrifice, wanton and lewd sexuality, criminality, bestial hygiene, and dress. All of these literatures proliferate and become popular in Spain, becomes popular reading among the aristocracy, right, to read about these crazy people that the Spaniards have discovered. But on the other hand, many of Vittoria's own brothers are contesting these accounts, describing instead, if not a peaceable people, a people with learning and self-governance, with complex rules of social behavior and all the other markers associated with civilization, even if in more rudimentary form, these Spanish, Dominicans, and in some cases Jesuits are arguing. Based on these accounts and the Thomistic philosophic tradition in which he works, Vittoria refutes many of the possible justifications for Spanish rule over the Indians, including dubious claims rooted in the gift to Spain from the Pope of all undiscovered lands. Right, that was one of the initial legitimations of the right of the Spaniards to rule, was this document that people thought had the Pope, by which the Pope had donated all the undiscovered lands in the West to the Spanish and to the Portuguese. And Vittoria just says, not aside from whether it's actually legitimate, which it turns out to be a forgery, by the way, the Pope doesn't have that authority, according to him. And he writes essays on ecclesiastical power, civil power, where he discusses these kinds of issues. He just doesn't think the Pope has that kind of power, which puts him at odds with other people. But of Mayer's claim that in the Indians we have proof of Aristotle's theory of natural slavery, he argues to the contrary. He grants for the sake of argument, okay? He's good at arguing. He's Dominican, right? He grants for the sake of argument that something that he actually probably doesn't believe. None more fit the bill of natural slaves than these barbarians, who appear little different from brute animals. Okay, that's what everybody's arguing. He says, okay, fine, let's just accept that for the sake of this argument, that they really look, you know, no different from brute animals, or behave no different from brute animals. He argues instead, however, the burden of proving that they are natural slaves fall on the Spaniards. Okay? They don't have to establish their humanity. We have to assume instead their humanity, and now the Spaniards have to show that they are, in fact, natural slaves. Failing proof to the contrary, they must be held true masters and may not be dispossessed without due cause, he writes. Before the Spaniards arrived, they had ordered possession. They had cities and governance and laws. They had complex crafts and arts. He concedes the theoretical point that a slave could be a slave even without a master, right? So in other words, they may have just been there waiting for masters to come, right, to arrive and sort of confirm the fact that they are slaves. Right, he concedes, again, that's a point out of Aristotle, or it's accepted to be a kind of Aristotelian point. But in the case of the Indians, that they are slaves has to be shown by the Spaniards, and he does not think they've shown it. To show that their dress and manners is backward is not sufficient, he argues. Spanish peasants are no less beastly, he writes, than are the Indians. And no one, seriously, doubts the humanity of the Spanish peasantry. The Indians, then, do not need to prove the legitimacy of their dominium. Instead, to say that they have dominium, as he does, is to bring in all the aspects of that term. Much of which, of course, he gets from Thomas Aquinas. Dominium doesn't just mean rights of possession. It's literally property rights, right? Literally property rights, that this is my thing, okay? Right? But it doesn't just mean that. It means mastery, of self and agency, human agency. So if you think, again, if you know the Aristotelian sort of scheme about natural philosophy, right, the natural slave, according to Aristotle, can't be self-directing. Right, because they lack rationality, and because they can follow orders, they can be told what to do, dig the ditch, right, lift the rock, do whatever, but they can't be self-directing. He's arguing instead these people are in fact self-directing. So they are therefore persons, according to Vittoria. They are persons, and persons have right in property unless there is some defect preventing them from possession. Okay, now we're going to turn to the defects that he then entertains, because these are all things that other people are arguing against him. There are four possible defects that are advanced against Indian claims to dominium. First, that they are mortal sinners. Cannibalism, child sacrifice, right? Lewd sexual activity and so on, right? They're mortal sinners. Second, that they are unbelievers. They don't follow the Christian or true faith. Third, that they are irrational like animals. Okay? And he also, under this category, entertains the possibility that they're like children. Okay? Because if they're like animals or like children, some argue, then they can't actually possess rights. They can't be wronged, is another way to put this. Right? When you say somebody possesses rights, that means they can be wronged. And the fourth of these is that they are mad, okay, that they're crazy, right, that they're lunatic. And he considers all four of those and rejects them all. The relationship of dominium to mortal sin, I think, gives him the most difficulty, right, that they might be mortal sinners. To rebut the reasonable claims that sin vitiates dominium, right, it seems kind of reasonable to say this, right, that if somebody is in a state of mortal sin, they should not have possession any longer, right? And in fact, it's, you know, sometimes argued a kind of apt punishment of somebody's sinfulness that we take away their possessions. So to rebut this claim, he advances a strong connection between civil ownership and natural dominium, okay, between civil ownership and natural dominium. There are good reasons to think that sin or bad behavior is a defect affecting possession. The sinner seems to lose the favor of God, perhaps even to the point of undermining his claim to something, or worse, by his sin erasing his very resemblance to God. Okay? Vittoria dismisses these arguments as the product of heretical Protestant thinking. This is what the Protestants think. And in fact, it is what at least some Protestants against which he and others have been arguing, that, for instance, a king cannot be a king if he's in a state of mortal sin. He forfeits his right to rule by virtue of, you know, his behavior. I mean, one could think about, you know, contemporary politics and, you know, the relationship of good behavior, right, to the right to rule and so on, right? And Vittoria rejects this. Says, you know, they rule nonetheless. They rule legitimately nonetheless despite their sinfulness. Possession, he argues, is rooted in human nature, in the image of God shared in the person, and not even sin erases that likeness. Okay? This is a critical move, right? A critical argument that he's making. Not even sin erases the image of God in the person. And that, right, because of that, a person cannot lose his civil dominium. If he did, Vittoria thinks, you'd also be undermining his natural dominion as well, right? He finds them so closely connected that to take away the person's civil rights to ownership would bleed all the way back into their natural rights of ownership. Because, and this is why I said, this is where I think he has a little bit of trouble, but anyway, this is his claim. The image of the God in the human is not vitiated by sin. The sinner does not lose his dominion over his acts and his body, nor even his right of self-defense, Vittoria argues. So if sin does not erase natural dominion, it cannot, he believes, undermine civil ownership. And he finds this all confirmed in Scripture, where we see evil men like Solomon and Ahab, and these are his examples, made kings. He does the same thing with the three other defects as well. So like he even addresses the issue of like they're irrational, again, which is related again to the natural slavery claim. They're irrational. And under this one, he looks at children. People also, you know, often claim, he argues, that children cannot be possessors of rights. They don't have rights of ownership. And he says this is just false. Children can be wrong. He argues, he shows it's false by saying children can clearly be wronged by people taking things away from them that are their due, that they are, right, that they possess or they should be able to anticipate, like even the care of a parent. So he believes that even children are possessors of rights. Now, the non-human animal kingdom, he does not regard as in any respect the possessors of rights, right? So even if we want to say he's in some way, right, a kind of modern thinker, a progressive thinker with regard to rights, he does not have any space for the rights of the animal kingdom, the rights of animals, and so on. But he does, however, advance a surprisingly modern conception of the human person who has command or dominion over his or her own actions, and if having that command, therefore, even in the case of a mortal sinner, unable to be disabused of his or her property without offense to his or her dominion overall. Any rational creature, including children, possesses dominion, he believes, and neither sin, nor unbelief, nor madness, nor supposed irrationality can undo any of that. And, as we saw earlier, the Indians are rational creatures, therefore they cannot be dispossessed by the Spaniards. What we see here, then, is a profoundly expansive, even humanitarian view of personhood. Where many of his peers see in the Indians confirmation of natural-born slaves or human beings lacking in full rationality, Vittoria sees men, men like the Spaniards themselves. So we need only reflect a moment to see the argument for Vittoria as the conscience of his age, against public and governmental pressure, against the pressure of national pride and wealth, against historical and theological precedent. Vittoria undermines every claim that the crown and the church make justifying Spanish imperialism in the Americas. In addition, his responses rework or rebut some of the authorities of his age in favor of carving out a conception of the rational human being as a bearer of a right to possession without qualification. He does not think the possession of rights is rooted in anything other than human nature. He does not think the Spaniards could take things from the Indians because they were not citizens of a European principality. But of course, tracing the emergence of a concept is harder than this. And any moment or thinker is a product of streams of thought and groups of thinkers reflecting on similar ideas. Vittoria is himself a part of a cohort of Spanish theologians and canonists and religious who called on the crown to desist its dispossession of the Indians and who also rejected the church's claims to jurisdiction over them. Historians of the period have noted the exceptional nature of the disputes over the legitimacy of Castilian colonization in the Americas. The disputes occurred at the highest level of public governance and were not just sanctioned by, but commissioned by the monarchs, like Charles V calls a commission to study these issues. As I said before, they passed these laws in the early 1500s, you know, promulgated, you know, legislation that is designed to curb these abuses. Vittoria and other Spanish intellectuals remind the crown of its responsibilities to their faith, from which derive these moral principles for treating its subjects, including the new subjects they have found. The task of its theologians, an historian wrote, was to ensure that it acted or was seen to act on all occasions in strict accordance with Christian ethico-political principles. Convinced that they were partially successful, the historian Lewis Hankey has argued, the Spanish conquest of America was far more than a remarkable military and political exploit. that it was one of the greatest attempts the world has seen to make Christian precepts prevail in the relations between peoples. Many have echoed Hanke's acclamation of the Spanish theologians, philosophers, and canonists. Historian Anthony Pagnant more recently has written, "The extent and the intensity of the struggle over the rights of Spaniards in America are perhaps unequaled in the history of European colonization." Vittoria's reflections on the humanity of the Indians don't end with his rejection of the idea that the Indians are not members of the class of human beings. Once he has established that they are human beings, he turns to the possible just titles by which the Spaniards might gain rule over them. The first of these, and I'm going to go through this quickly, is the right of natural society and communication. Vittoria locates this right in the jus gentium, which he claims either is or derives from the natural law. The jus gentium, sometimes referred to as the law of nation, the law of peoples, sometimes called a kind of prototypical international law, and that's why I'm kind of looking at it right now, is because it seems to have some relationship to what we think about when we think about the natural law. He makes the jus gentium very, very close to the natural law, probably closer than Thomas Aquinas does. Aquinas, who Vittoria follows and develops, places it somewhere in the middle ground, the jus gentium, somewhere in the middle ground between the natural law and the positive law, even if somewhat towards the natural law. But Thomas would not write, as Vittoria does, that the jus gentium either is or derives from the natural law. He wouldn't write that either is part. He would see it as a derivation from it. In fact, this is a quotation from Thomas. To the law of nations belongs those things which are derived from the law of nature as conclusions from premises. And as we just saw, Vittoria is really driving them sort of very closely together. This close connection of the jus gentium and its right of communication to the natural law elevates its status. It elevates its binding status. If it's really close to the natural law, it seems less like a prudential derivation from it and more like something that's normatively binding, sort of regardless of situation or circumstances that we might associate with prudential reasoning. The thrust of his prior argument established with great passion and persuasiveness the case for the admission of Indians into the family of human beings, with legitimate legal standing as owners and free agents. That claim, coupled with this conception of the right of communication as of the natural law, connects the Indians to the Spaniards as neighbors. Okay, this is where, like, this is like the point, okay? It connects the Indians to the Spaniards as neighbors and invites them to share free passage with each other. So Vittoria argues, the Spaniards have the right to travel and dwell among the Indians, so long as they do no harm to the barbarians and cannot be prevented by them from doing so. And not only do the Spaniards have a right to travel and dwell among the Indians, so do the Indians have the same right with regard to the Spaniards. So just as he had done before, he draws the obvious conclusion. This same right of communication forbids Spaniards from excluding French travelers, right, and would require the Spaniards to welcome Indian travelers into their nation. I hope you can see there's a kind of an unfortunate consequence of that as well, right? I mean, the story of human rights, the story of these kinds of things is not always, not ever probably, like simply rosy, right? But we'll talk about, perhaps the darker side of this in a moment. He connects this expansive right of communication to the natural law by arguing that common possession itself is of the natural law, and the division of things into property is not contrary to common possession. Because common possession is of the natural law and thus prior to the division of things, no human law contrived by the Spaniards or the Indians could prevent the other from entering the other's land. Okay? So human law is measured by the natural law and the jus gentium. Right? And no laws that the Spaniards, the French, the Indians could pass could contravene the prior right of people to travel and treat each other as neighbors. The force of this, of course, is clear, right? The Spaniards and the Indians are like brothers. They're like neighbors to each other. And in this case, the Spaniards are permitted to enter Indian lands and even to take those things that are held by Indians in superabundance and lacking in Spain. Okay? These laws are superior to civil laws. The laws of the jus gentium, or the natural law, measure the legitimacy of the civil law and thus bind the Indians and the Spaniards to each other as neighbors. They are all members of the same human family and thus subject to the natural law and through that to the jus gentium and subject to the needs of the others, to, you know, in other words, to coming to the aid of others who are in need as brother or as neighbors. So on the one hand, and this I'm going to conclude now, this is a remarkably expansive conception of a human community and intercourse and can contribute to a cosmopolitan conception of humanity, a world without borders, as a recent Atlantic article argues. Vittoria refers in his writings throughout to the Indians and the Spaniards in the theological categories of neighbors and brothers and appeals to gospel principles of treatment appropriate to these categories. No human law, as I said, can abrogate these principles. His account of the right of communication seems fresh and in step with much contemporary thinking on the rights of people to migrate, to trade with each other, to engage in friendly intercourse, and the limitations on governments to prevent them from doing so. In other words, right, it seems really open-minded towards, you know, a kind of capacious understanding of immigration. It seems no stretch, then, at all to recognize that Vittoria here articulates what we would today call human rights. And he also articulates a kind of prototypical basis of the international law. This is why I think he's called the father of the international law, and perhaps why, as well, we might want to consider him the father of modern human rights. I'll stop there. I think there's a lot of stuff to talk about. I hope you have some questions, but thank you very much.
I think we lost the microphone, so...
This one or that one?
No, yours, the one on you is fine, so if you want to move around. That's what happened with the projector, so...
Oh, like the power... Oh, it's probably this thing or something, right?
Maybe. Somebody probably somewhere in some control room turned it off. So, thank you, and we'll open for questions now, so... and you can feel free to roam as you like.
Well, any questions? Andrew.
Do we know about him because he was successful and the ideas that he put forth were implemented, or?
No, we know about him primarily because he's the founder of something called the Second Scholastic, or the School of Salamanca is another way to refer to it. And that is, and this is very important to the Thomistic Institute, he introduces to Spain and to then another generation of thinkers the works of Thomas, which, if you may not know, it's not like everybody's always reading Thomas throughout, you know, history. Thomas writes, and everybody's like, "Oh my gosh!" Right? And you can't stop thinking about Thomas. Right? It waxes and wanes in history, and Vittoria is one of those during whose time it waxes. He reintroduces the thought of Thomas. And works in Thomas's texts very, very closely. So he becomes the founder of this fantastic school of Spanish thinkers. Francisco Suarez is another one. De Soto. I mean, there are some names associated with this that are very, very important. Suarez is another person who people will often think of as a founder of international law. If you think about when they're writing, the time when the world is transforming from really imperial, from almost like an imperial stage to the stage of nation states, which will only be, you know, a little while later than these guys are writing. You have the emergence of international law. You have the emergence of states and their contestations with each other. Hugo Grotius, who's a name who many people, certainly the Protestant, you know, sort of narrative would be, there's the foundation of natural law. It's with Grotius, who's a Protestant. But he's influenced by Vittoria and Suarez and so on. So it's really intellectually why they're carried forward, because, quite frankly, the argumentation that you saw today is really a failure, right? I mean, if you measure it by, well, did they change things, right? The answer to that would be not really. The forces that I describe of commercialization, the forces of, you know, I mean, simply the fact, of course, that the Spanish crown is less concerned in a way with the abuses in the Americas than it is with its maintaining its power in Europe and its, you know, its challengers to its own power in Europe. So it can't really do anything about abuses over there. And of course, it's becoming spectacularly wealthy. by the resources it's getting from the New World. So unfortunately, it kind of fails. Yes?
Might be a little bit garbled.
Yeah.
But you mentioned early in your talk that the ideas of human rights, I guess kind of in the Western world, didn't really evolve until like the 1970s.
That's a claim of this author that I was referring to. Right.
My question is John Locke's natural laws. He believed that in the state of nature, all human beings have the right to life, liberty, and property. I don't know if you would know this, but it was Locke maybe influenced by Victoria?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are really almost, I think, two parts of the question. One is, like, wouldn't what Locke writes itself be a challenge to what Moyne is arguing, right?
Yes.
You know, I mean, like, wouldn't this be, like, look, you know, go back, you already see things like that. And I think, you know, trying to be fair to what Moyne is advancing, I think, again, he's got a very, he wants to really have advanced kind of very specific understanding of human rights, look, what is Locke's failure? Locke's not as bad as those other guys are, but right, typically the failure is women, right? Dealing with the problem of women, although Locke is actually pretty good on this, right? Compared to his peers, right? So I don't know more, you know, I don't know how Moyne would deal with that. I mean, it's really weird. Moyne points to Jimmy Carter and Jimmy Carter's introduction of human rights language, which we all remember, right? Some of us in the room remember, right? It's really, you know, as being important to his foreign policy, right? He looks at that as, you know, that moment really is expressing this new thing that even again he thinks you don't see with the UN Declaration on Rights, which is kind of, it's, at that point you're arguing about, I think, for something that's so arcane. Right, that it's not clear how much power it has. With Locke, I don't know, right? I don't know. And, like, even with John Major or John Mayer, right, some people argue that he was the direct teacher of Victoria. Some people say, no, that he clearly wasn't a teacher. It's hard to establish direct roots for a lot of these guys. But for sure, Locke would have been influenced by other ideas, like from Grotius and so on, right? So, I think. So I don't know, indirectly maybe? I don't know. It's a great question, right? It's a history of ideas question.
Yeah, they just sound, the rights that Victoria advanced as, you know, human rights sound very similar to Locke.
But he's
liberty and property.
But he doesn't claim them. I mean, this is one of the important differences, right? And this goes to people who are trying to trace when does the rights language come into being. For Victoria, it's not that person over there in isolation has, you know, a kind of catalog of rights that they can appeal to. Instead, he's just, it's almost like an anthropological or ethnographic thing. And he's just looking at peoples and saying, these are peoples. And peoples we know, right, can be human beings as, you know, members of communities, right, possess. Again, he doesn't even, like, it's not even that they possess these things, right? But they must be treated in certain kinds of ways that are in accord with their creation and the dignity and likeness of God, right? And that allows us to evangelize them, for instance, right? And that's really the first thing for all these guys, is that this is all about evangelization, right? Can we evangelize these people or not? And once we can, how do we do it, right? And the Spanish, who are arguing poorly, or from our perspective, poorly, even they're granting the evangelization thing, but they're saying, well, they can't take care of themselves, right? And they can't really be property owners. And he's arguing to the contrary. So there is for sure a difference. He's not, like, it's not...
Between individual rights and this kind of demographic.
I think so. Yeah, or between the way they possess it as subjects, as opposed to the way he's talking about rights. Yes.
I'm in a human rights class right now, and
one
of the criticisms we're dealing with, attention we're dealing with, is whether, like, human rights are actually universal or whether they're a product of the Western world.
Right.
And one of the big criticisms is, like, it's a tool of imperialism.
Right.
Which seems to be kind of in the narrative of De Victoria, because he's writing from Spain.
Right.
From America,
That's right.
To America. come true even?
Yeah, look, that's a great question, right? Like I said, like, the dark side of what he's writing is, and this is pointed out by his own peers, including Melchor Cano, who's another theologian, is writing, like, look, you're saying that the Spaniards can come as travelers, but would we call are we really coming? We call Alexander the Great a traveler, right? Like, you know, we're not really coming as travelers, right? We're coming as conquerors, right? We're coming and subjugating these people and so on. So certainly, like, historically, right, he's writing in the context of colonization and imperialism, right? No question about it. I think we'd have to concede that, right, and say, okay, but does that then void, right, the things that he's doing? Does that also disconnect what he's doing from the kinds of claims that we want to make about human rights? If we want to say that they're universal, if we want to say that people, by virtue of being, you know, whatever it is, for us, you know, created in the image of likeness of God, merit being treated in particular kinds of ways, is he doing that? And I think the answer is yes, he's doing that, right? He's doing that with all the shortcomings that are associated with being a human being writing at a particular moment. So when he's arguing, right, that the Spaniards can come and, you know, and the Indians have no right to say, no, you can't come in, and he says it's the same is true if the Indians come to us, we all know the Indians aren't going to get on the ship and come to the Spaniards, right? I mean, it's right, it's an asymmetrical, right, situation, power situation, right? I hate that kind of language, right? But it is asymmetrical. So, I mean, the temptation is to say just because it's associated with that, then the ideas are wrong, right? I think we have to admit it is associated with those things, right? And it did operate, perhaps to legitimize things for some people. But he was clearly challenging what he saw as abuses based on treating these people not as full human beings and arguing they need to be treated as full human beings. I hope that's one where your professor and you can have a conversation and you can sort of have a real give and take on this. Like, it doesn't undermine the idea simply because it was mounted in the context of imperialism. It was in part mounted against it, right? A lot of these guys are trying to argue against what they thought was the abuses associated with this, the rapacious way that the Spaniards were just taking everything and saying, it's ours. They didn't own it. They couldn't own it. It's good stuff, though. It's hard. Look, it's hard stuff, right? Yeah. There were arguments for and against all of these things, right? He and others who were arguing this view, like Las Casas himself, right, has a kind of famous exchange with Sepulveda, another thinker who's an Aristotle scholar, who argues, no, in fact, these guys are the natural slaves. And they're kind of marshaling the same kinds of arguments as Vittoria is. And the argument, I think, is done. It's not even done in person. It's done sort of like by lecture. I'd lecture here and the other guy would lecture, 8 months later somewhere else, almost like, chess, chess by mail that people used to do, right? You remember that? You guys don't know that, but we used to write useful chess by mail. I move my thing over here, 3 weeks later, get a letter and say, okay, my rook's over there now. And there was no resolution of that. It's not like somebody said, okay, the De Las Casas wins or the Vittorian position wins. Those things are just—they're judged by time, I mean, think about our own immigration conversations, or if there are conversations, right? Think about the way we talk about any issue, right? And if you get even smart people to say, "Here's a good approach, a good way to think about immigration." Forget about policy; I don't know policy, but here's principles for thinking about why states have certain kinds of rights to definite borders and to limit the numbers of people who enter and to make some sort of judgments about who enters and so on, and why, on the other hand, people have rights to move freely, especially under situations of distress. How do those arguments get resolved, right? Even when they're good people arguing them in good faith and doing it pretty well, time usually sifts through those things, sifts through those things and says, you know, look, really, they're arguing for natural slavery in the 16th, right, in the 16th century. They were arguing the indigenous populations. And that's the force of, when Vittoria says the Spanish peasants, I mean, don't think of, like, you know, I mean, you got to think of some backwards people, right? There were some backwards people then. And, I mean, they were, right? They just called them the masses then. They didn't even think of them as individuated human beings. They were just the masses. And he's like, look, there's really no difference between these guys and those guys. And we bring the sacraments to the Spanish peasantry. We should be doing the same thing to them and treating them the same way with the same kind of respect. These arguments are real. Everything he's engaging is real. All those positions that he refutes are real positions. And they get argued further. Yeah.
Following up with her question, did the church engage with his philosophy? Did they take a position for or against him in that time?
No, I mean, that's a good question too. You know, he's a member of the church, right? He's arguing from within the church. And there are people within the church who are sympathetic to what he says, and there are people who are not sympathetic to it. It's not, you know, we live in a different time, right? And we think of, well, what's the encyclical on this, right? Shouldn't there be an encyclical letter on this? And, right, there weren't encyclical letters in the same way that there are now, and that... you know, his becomes part of the theological corpus that all of us, you know, like a student of mine is here, you know, that Father and I work through and inform the way we think about these things. And they, you know, and this is how the church thinks about all these things. There are documents on enslavement. There are documents on, you know, removing people from situations of freedom and into enslavement that are associated with this. As I said, the monarchs of Spain think of themselves as good Catholics. This is why, I mean, it's so important to them to try to understand, is what they're doing legitimate? It's not, you know, I don't think we should at all be cynical about what motivates them. They're trying to figure out, does the faith allow us to do this, you know, or what does it allow us to do? And bringing in the best people that they can think of. Imagine, again, if, you know, our political leaders brought in the best, you know, minds, you know, to help us think about the immigration problem, you know. Not policy, just in terms of what rights, you know, what can we do towards people, what rights do people have to move, and so on. Yeah.
Kind of building the same sort of question is, like, I think it's easy to notice he's not a saint, so I'm sort of, like, the question is, like, what makes him credible as, like, a Catholic philosopher? I mean, yeah, he was a friar, but...
He was Dominican. he's not a doctor of the church, right? What makes him credible? His arguments make him credible. You know, ultimately, right? Truth is important here, right? And I think many of the things he says are true, and they're true. You know, we can know those things in different ways, right? We can know it because we study them, we look at them, we reflect on them, you know, we think about them. They seem to line up with reality, what we, you know, believe to be true about other human beings. They also seem true because they inform subsequent Catholic teaching. So, you know, I'm a theologian writing in the 21st century, right, who still goes back to Vittoria to get these very interesting ideas about the rights of people to migrate. Right, the rights of people to travel, and the relationship. This is critical. The relationship of all of this to the common purpose of all of creation. Right, that this is the first intention. Right, that God has is that all of creation is intended for all of us in common. Right, and Vittoria says this, and so you right. So if you're going to say to somebody, look, you can't move from there to there. Right, when the first intention, right, is that all of this is for everybody, you have to have a good reason for it, right? And there are good reasons. I'm not saying there aren't good reasons, right? Sin happens, right? And then things are divided into, right? The division of things. So now we claim certain kinds of things as property, and we believe that that is legitimate, right? But that's a derivation from the way things are supposed to be. And Vittoria advances all these ideas that are sort of rock solid first principles or second principles, maybe of second principles of Catholic teaching. You know, it's good stuff. You got to think about it. Other questions? Yes. He doesn't define it. He's just doing kind of a kind of anthropological thing. Look at these people. They seem to be people. They have all the markers of rationality, right? Again, like I said, and it's not that guy over there, right? It's those people have built a city. They have governance. They have leaders. They have subordinates to leaders. They have hierarchical organization. They have families. They have arts and crafts. I think as some of us know, right? Some of those cities that eventually the Spaniards are going to encounter are fantastically complex compared to Spain, right? I mean, they're not backwards. They're in fact advanced in some ways over Spain. No, he doesn't advance this is what a person is at all. But it's implicit in everything he's arguing that we're looking for markers of rationality. These are obvious markers of rationality, and they possess them all. Yeah. Which is, I think, is a nice way to proceed. It's very, somebody might argue, Thomistic, right? It's, what am I looking at? What is reality, right? What am I seeing? And how does what I'm seeing, sort of informing how I'm thinking about it?
So at the beginning of the talk, you were saying how different religious groups try to claim credit over the development of...
Yes, yeah.
So do you think that this Catholic person who developed the idea of, what a human person is and how they have rights, does that give us any ability to shape, Catholics, the ability to shape human rights?
I hope so. Yeah, great question. Right, I hope so. Like I said, this is the neat thing or the challenging thing about the neat and challenging thing about ideas, right? And really about life is that things are never closed off, and they what happens in the future always sort of changes the way we think about things that have happened or even ideas. And I think part of what's going on here with the argument about human rights is ideological, in a sense, right? That certain people want to understand human rights in certain ways, and one of the ways to do it is to cut it off, right, from any connection to, I keep saying, certain kinds of claims Christians would make, like being created in the image and likeness of God, and that not really depending upon whether you're a child, for instance, or somebody who looks like a natural slave, somebody who's slow, perhaps, big and goofy or whatever, right? Whatever that might be that sort of fits that, Vittoria is seeing through that to say, this is clearly false, right? I mean, among the other claims he would make is God doesn't create things in vain, right? So if there were such things as, beings that looked like they were natural slaves, they couldn't be, right? Or human beings, they couldn't be, right? God doesn't create things in vain. So if we connect the language or the emergence of human rights back to these older sources, I mean, I think you get obvious, right, ways of reading forward that it's going to have a kind of moral traction to saying we can't exclude people from human rights because they're really sick, right, really elderly, right, no longer doing certain kinds of things that we associate with being a human and so on, right? They look human, right? All their lives they've been human, or we know what they're going to be, right? So, yeah, I hope it opens us up to reclaiming the language of human rights in a way that can make sense of certain kinds of human rights claims as legitimate and certain as illegitimate. Other questions? Young man. That fellow and then you, okay? Okay, got it. I'm sorry, yeah.
I was wondering where in his works he discusses
Yeah.
Citation or something. I just want to know my own study.
Yeah, I can get that to you if you want to come up afterwards. I can give you some more stuff on it. I think Barrett's been working on that, hasn't he? Have you done any work on it? Okay. Yeah, come up to me afterwards. We can talk about that. Yes?
Yeah, the Spanish rulers at that time, they looked upon these native people as people that we could turn into Christians.
Right.
And how do they make this distinction between somebody who is a Christian and this person from Spain who was born here is also a Christian, but he has more human rights than this.
Right, or he's more human or something.
He's
yeah.
More human.
Yeah, look, that's a great question, and it goes to the slavery is often referred to as the peculiar institution. Have you ever heard that term for slavery? Right. It's the paradox of thinking of people as slaves, right? Or thinking of people in these ways that some of the Spaniards clearly wanted to think of them as. On the one hand, they're human enough to be evangelized or like a slave, human enough to be subject to the law, right? And punished in accordance with the law. On the other hand, they're not human enough to be fully considered one of us, therefore, you know, we wouldn't treat them in these, you know, inhumane ways or with slaves, right? They could be punished by the law, but they couldn't bring, right? They couldn't be protected by the law, right? I mean, it's bizarre. And I think that's why people call it peculiar. It's really paradoxical, or it actually doesn't go together, right? So I don't think they did that well. You know, I think on the one hand, they had a genuine impulse to evangelize and recognized, you know, the humanity enough and recognized these people as appropriate subjects of evangelization, right? And that's a good thing. On the other hand, they were blinded by their biases, right? They were blinded by, you know, prejudices like, you know, we can be. Remember, most of this stuff was based on reports, because there's no video. You couldn't get in a plane and fly over and take a look at them. A lot of it was based on reports, and we're trying to sort through fake news ourselves these days to get to what's accurately reporting something. Can you imagine what it'd be like then not to have any like actual firsthand engagement with the people who we're all talking about, and then have somebody say, well, they're like the sort of fantastical description I presented to you. Then some crazy Dominican or something coming up to you and saying, no, look, I mean, actually, they're a lot like us. So, you know, they have governance, they have cities, they have irrigation. They have all these, you know, kinds of things that we associated with it. It would be hard for us, I think, too, to make these distinctions, and they failed in many cases, right? They simply failed, again, the way we will fail in so many ways as well. But that's a great question, because there's no doubt about it. It embraces a kind of paradox, right? We can evangelize them, but we can also take their stuff, right? Okay, yeah.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Spanish is hard.
I'm sure Professor Capizzi will stick around if y'all have